Entertaining. Cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
Hey, this is J. Michael Michael for LA Talk Radio. And if you're like me, you love talk radio. And if you're like me, you can't find anything worth listening to on the AM dial. How about this? How about you try out LA Talk Radio? See, LA Talk Radio is a .com, and we're the best in the business, and we've got everything from sports to music to talk to just about anything you want to do, including cleaning your head with some psychology. And, of course, right now, we're doing the new writer's very favorite show, The Writer's Block. So sit back, enjoy yourself, grab a bottle of wine, a box of chocolates, because it all starts right now.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Russ Avison right here on LA Talk Radio.
When I was a young boy, my age was barely 10, riding my first roundup with the older boys and men. Foreman sent our best hand where lesser men might fail to ride the outside circle, the longest, roughest trail. And I watched that top pan ride out on a skittish colt that day. And once on a distant ridge, I saw him turning horns my way.
That is Michael Blakely, and the song is called The Outer Circle from his album of the same name, The Outer Circle. And this is LA Talk Radio. You're listening to The Writer's Block. I am your host, Jim Christina, in studio, supposed to be with Russell Avison, but of course he is not here tonight. He has been sick, and it's his fiance's birthday, so he's out. And on the phone with me right now is Bobby Jean Bell sitting in, so we'll just call you Russ. How's that, Bobby?
You call me whatever you like. I'm delighted to be here.
besides late for dinner, huh? Yep. Hey, you getting excited about coming out?
I am. I can't believe in two weeks.
2 weeks,
yeah. I will have made my second appearance in the studio.
That's
for
true.
The
actually,
block. I'm so excited.
Actually, you're going to be making your second and third because you'll be here with Junie Fisher as well.
Right, on this, yeah.
On the 9th and then the 11th.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're looking forward to having you, because it's always fun when you're in the studio anyway, so.
It's been a year.
I know, huh? It's just like, oh, we miss you.
So, yes, and Junie Fisher left a lovely message on Facebook today about how much she's a fan of our guest tonight.
Well, you know what? To be quite frank with you, I had never heard any of Mike's songs until you sent them to me the other day. Mm-hmm. And I listened to him and I said, oh my God, I got to open with this song. This is a great tune.
It is. And the song Outside Circle did win an award, Song of the Year, the Spur Award.
Well,
and it was, and Mike and the song and the CD were four nominations with the International Western Music Association last fall. So,
right.
And then he's an amazing writer. So
yes. So we have some more of his music we'll be playing a little bit later on. But right now, Mike is the author of 18 novels marketed nationwide by Forge Books in New York City and other major publishers. Most of his books are historical novels set in the American West. He has served as president of Western Writers of America and has taught fiction writing at numerous workshops across the U.S. In 2001, Mike won the Spur Award for Best Western Novel of the Year from Western Writers of America for his book, Summer of Pearls. He has co-authored novels with two country music legends, Willie Nelson, A Tale Out of Luck, and Kenny Rogers, What Are the Chances? Mike is also a performing singer-songwriter who plays 150 live shows a year. His songs have been recorded by Alan Jackson, Raul Malo, Flaco Jimenez, Red Stegall, and many others. Please welcome to the Writer's Block, Mr. Mike Blakely.
Hey, Jim.
Hey, Mike, you're a busy guy. How do you find time to sit down and write a 512-page novel?
Well, it It sure did take some time. I think my publisher was saying, when are you going to finish that book? But just the research on this particular book took a lot of time. I'm using all real people as my characters, real people involved with the Mexican War, sometimes called the Mexican-American War.
Right, right, right.
The 1840s. Not the Mexican Revolution, but nope. The Mexican War between the Alamo and the Civil War. That's our time.
There you go. And it was 1846 to 1848, if my history serves.
You got it. You're right.
So, yeah.
And so the research, because I'm using all real people, uh-huh. was in-depth. And so I just wanted to get it right and try to give people an idea of what the war was all about and why it happened in the first place. There's a little bit of politics involved. Most of it takes place in the field, though, with people who are actually in the armies, both the U.S. Army and I have some characters in the Mexican Army as well.
Right, right, right. And there was actually a big battalion of the Irish regulars, and then most of the European countries got guys in there with the St. Patrick's Battalion Brigade.
That's a pretty big part of my story because it's so unusual that there were a large number of immigrants, especially Irish immigrants, who deserted the U.S. Army. There were a large number of immigrants in the Army anyway because they needed to work.
Sure.
And there were reasons for that. An unfortunate anti-immigrant and especially anti-Irish and anti-Catholic movement had cropped up across the U.S. and had kind of worked its way into the U.S. Army as well.
Uh-huh.
And a few of the officers, these West Point officers, had bought into this anti-immigrant system and were brutalizing way too overbearing on these immigrant soldiers, and so they just started deserting to go across the Rio Grande and fight with their fellow Mexican Army. They thought that was going to be a better fit for them, and so a large number did that. And one particular man, an Irish immigrant named John Riley, became the leader of this San Patricio's, or the St. Patrick's Battalion.
Right.
It was an artillery battalion in the Mexican Army. So it's a very unusual story, but it's the true story, and it's part of what really happened.
Right, and even the American officers that fought them says the hardest battles ever fought were against the St. Patrick's Battalion.
Well, that's true, and part of the reason that they were, you know, Irishmen were always known as fighters.
Yeah, they're good fighters anyway. Yeah.
But in this particular case, they knew that if they got captured, they were probably going to be hanged.
Well, sure, because they were deserters. Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, yeah. Well, the name of your book, A Sinister Splendor. Where did that title come from?
Well, I was doing the research from some of the Mexican soldiers who fought in the war. And one of the Mexican officers was given the unenviable task of writing a history about the war. And, of course, it's in Spanish, and I don't read Spanish fluently, but there is a translation of the book. And he described one of the early battles, the Battle of Palo Alto in Texas. And there was a fire that broke out on the battlefield. It was a bunch of tall, dead grass, and this fire roared across the battlefield. And he said it roared between the two armies with a sinister splendor.
Those words.
And I thought, well, I just like that representation for the whole war. You know, it was
splendid
at times, and it was sinister at times. And, you know, there was glory, and there was horror, and everything in between.
Well, I have to tell you that, and I will mea culpa here at this point, because I have been sick for the last 2 weeks, and I didn't make it all the way through your book, and I apologize. But I got enough of it to really, 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 and you know, as I'm reading along and I'm reading the dialogue and your characters, I mean, you know, your characters are coming out and they pop at you, and I think they pop at you because you start believing it's really them talking, and I think that really takes a talent when you're listening, you're reading dialogue from a character that has been a historical figure, and you start believing that that's really him talking. So kudos.
Well, thank you very much, and that's of course extremely important part of the novelist's job. If you don't have characters that speak with authenticity and in a natural manner, and they also have to have different voices. Everybody's got a different voice,
exactly.
Different attitude, different vocabulary. So, I work hard at doing that. So it's nice to get a compliment like that. So I appreciate it.
I enjoyed the dialogue very much, and it was fascinating. This is not a period that I know a lot about. when you talk about the Irish immigrant in the military, I always was thinking that that was later, more after the Civil War and 7th Cavalry and so forth. And I was stunned by the details that you go into on the way they were so often mistreated. I also found it your opening chapter showing us a young Ulysses S. Grant,
right,
who that's not really his correct name. What was his real name?
His real name on his birth certificate was Hiram Ulysses Grant, and he was his name was misrecorded when he at West Point when he got the okay to go to West Point. A congressman who arranged it for him didn't know his name. He thought his first name was Ulysses because everybody called him Ulysses or Lys, and he didn't know what the middle name was, so he gave him his Simpson because he knew that was the boy's mother's name.
Right.
Name. That's where they used to do it back then. So his name was erroneously recorded as Ulysses Simpson Grant.
Right.
And he didn't mind that because people started calling him U.S. Grant or Uncle Sam Grant.
Right.
And Sam.
And
stuck.
Sam, yeah.
So everybody
Sam
at West Point in the Army for many years called him Sam Grant.
That was fascinating. Sam. Well, and in that opening scene, he's looking at that creek that has totally overrun the banks, and you tell us something very important about him that I didn't really know, which is he never goes backwards. He's
yeah.
You know, we begin to see Grant as this young man, and we recognize that this is the man that goes through some crucibles and gets us through the Civil War.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
He had a superstition, and he didn't even know where it came from. He wrote about it in his memoirs, that he just, if he would pass up a turn that he was supposed to have taken and realize it a mile or two later, he would not backtrack and take the turn. He would find another way around. He just had this strange, unexplainable obsession with always going forward and never backing up.
Mm-hmm. That was very interesting.
That's what happened on that day when he was getting ready to cross that flooded creek to go propose to the girl he was in love with.
Yeah.
That would be Julia.
Yeah.
That would be the future Mrs. Grant.
Well, I think we need to have those interludes when there's a lot of combat going on. You know, we do, even though we don't have any combat yet in that very first chapter, you set up these characters, the same thing with Polk. I thought so much of how you set up who becomes President Polk was very interesting, that he met people every morning in the White House, I guess in the White House, and let people come and call on him. It sure is different today, isn't it, Mike?
Well, it really is, yeah. But that was the tradition for presidents for a long time.
Oh, yeah, Lincoln used to do the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, but so the listeners know that Polk, President James K. Polk, who's president during the whole Mexican War and really pushed the war, he would spend every morning from 8 a.m. to noon seeing just whichever citizen wanted to stop by and knock on the door. You know, there's no Secret Service. There was none of that. People would just stop by and want to talk to the president. So that's what he did almost every weekday while he was president.
Amazing.
It was interesting. It means a lot.
Yeah. Now you can't. I mean, you got to go through 17 layers, and then you're lucky if you even get a note back.
That's right.
And his relationship with his wife is wonderful too. Some very interesting couples you give us in this book.
Well, and they were an interesting couple because James K. Polk was a really hard worker, and he was a hard-nosed politician, but he had almost zero personality. He had no sense of humor. He didn't really socialize well. And his wife made up for all that because she was very charming and was very social, and she did have a sense of humor, and so she covered for him in those kind of situations.
Huh. I wonder how people like that get together.
Well, in this particular case, James K. Polk was so idolized Andrew Jackson that when he was a young single bachelor politician in Tennessee, Andrew Jackson told him, he pointed out that girl, and he said, "That's the girl you need to marry right there. She'd be good for your career." And he so idolized Jackson, he did what Jackson said, and he met Sarah and courted her, and by golly, he married her just like Andrew Jackson told him to do.
Well, there you go. I guess it pays to listen to presidents when they talk to you, huh?
That paid off for him.
Yeah. I like the way your setting of this novel is. It's like, I mean, you go through everything with it. You go through Polk pushing the Mexicans because they want, you know, he says our border is the Rio Grande, and they're saying no, it's the Nueces River, and it just back and forth, and they were calling the Rio Grande at that point the Rio Bravo.
Right.
And the whole thing started over the Nueces Strip. Can you kind of go through that a little bit?
Yeah, you know, Texas, before it became a state, had been a republic for 10 years. When you know, the Alamo and Sam Houston and Jim Bowie and Willie Barrett Travis, all these Texas names, the Alamo happened, and then Texas won its independence and became a republic for 10 years. They beat Santa Anna's army. They captured Santa Anna.
Right.
And Santa Anna signed a treaty saying, okay, I'm going to give you Texas as a republic, because they were afraid they were going to execute him. You're now a republic. I'll sign Texas over to you, and the border will be the Rio Grande del Norte or the Rio Bravo. It depends on who you're asking is what it was called.
Right.
So that was in a treaty by Santa Anna. But later on, Santa Anna worked his way out of that situation, got back into power in Mexico, and said, no, that was never really true, that he did that under duress. And the true border is the Nueces River, because they didn't want to give up the Rio Grande is a border, because it goes all the way up into New Mexico and what is now Colorado. And they didn't want to give up that much, you know, acreage. So that was one of the problems that brought the war on. Mexico had always said that if the Republic of Texas tried to join the Union, there would be war between the U.S. and Mexico. And even during the 10 years as a Texas Republic, there was constant skirmishing and warfare between the Republic of Texas and Mexico. So it was just an ongoing war for this Nueces Strip, as they call it, the strip of land between the Nueces and the Rio Grande.
There you go. See, Bobby,
my property, you know, nobody wanted to give it up.
There you go. So stick around, Bobby, you'll learn something.
Well, that's what I thought was so interesting about Polk, because in my mind, the only major thing that I think about him is he's really the one that makes the acclamation that there is gold in California, right? In 1848. And I don't think of him as really, that's like his claim to fame. So this was just fascinating to me.
Oh yeah, Polk did a lot of stuff.
Polk was interesting because he when he won the presidency, he told everybody he would not run for re-election. He would only serve for 4 years, and he stuck to that. And he got everything he wanted to do done in 4 years. One was bring Texas into the U.S. and protect it as the new state. The other was to bring California in, which meant everything between Texas and California, and to take that away from Mexico, purchase it if they could or whatever, any way they could get it. And to solve the Oregon question was another thing, and we almost went to war with Oregon, with Great Britain and with Mexico at the same time, because Great Britain wanted Oregon too. So it was a dicey period in politics, and Polk, by golly, he got everything done that he wanted to do, and then a couple of months after he got out of the presidency, he died.
Right.
He pretty much worked himself to death. He wasn't that old either. Mm-hmm. He was at the time the youngest president who had served.
Yes, that's right. You point that out. Yeah, that's right. And Mike, with a book this long and covering so much, what did you have to edit out?
Did you? That's got to be an answer and a half, I have to tell you.
First of all, the book was supposed to cover the entire war, and this book only covers the first half of the war, the first phase of the war. And I wrote my publisher one day, and I said, "This is things are getting too big. There's too much information. Can I send you a book proposal on how to divide this into two books, and get a separate book in the works, in the plans?" And I sent them the proposal, and they liked it. They liked the fact that it was going to be a two-book deal. There's a natural breaking spot in the war, both geographically and because of the personalities. The first book, this one that's just come out, A Sinister Splendor, in this book, General Zachary Taylor is the commanding officer.
Right.
And then he kind of got worked out for political reasons. And in the second half, which is the sequel, which I'm writing now, General Winfield Scott was in charge. And so there's a natural break between the commanding officers, for one thing. The first phase takes place in southern Texas and in northern Mexico. And in the second phase, most of the fighting moves way down south to Mexico City and Veracruz.
Right, Veracruz, yeah.
So it's a geographical break there as well. So it just seemed like the best way to do it. And what did I have to leave out? There was so much stuff to choose from. I just decided, you know, I'm going to go for the most exciting parts, the most pivotal parts, the little things that happened that caused this conflict to happen, or caused one side to get the better of the other, or whatever. I just tried to keep it moving and not get bogged down with stuff that I would have to edit out. I hope that makes sense.
It does. Totally. Well, the book is A Sinister Splendor. Let's talk a little bit about your other works real quick. You've got, 18, 19 books out now?
Yeah.
Something like that.
Holy crap.
Yep. Pushing 20.
Yeah. Well, congratulations.
I've been doing this a long time. I've been doing this for 30 years. So that's not even a book a year. Mm. And I've been cranking it, but I have that music career thing that kind of takes a lot of time too. So.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to talk about that too.
Do you work on more than one project at a time, Mike, or are you just really focused on whatever's at hand?
With books, I only work on one book at a time. Uh-huh. I just want to focus totally on that story, get it done. Now I may be cooking up ideas for the next book, but. I don't try to write two at a time. I know a lot of people have done that. Louis L'Amour always wrote two at a time. He had two different typewriters, each with a different book in it.
Oh.
So that's the way he did it. But I'm working on enough other stuff, as you know, we all just mentioned, that and y'all were kind enough to play part of my song there at the top of the show. And, you know, I've got all the music stuff going. And so that's the other thing I'm working on when I'm not writing a book.
Well, we've got three more pieces we can play pieces of.
And you do a show with your dad. You have the Swing Riders that you...
Yeah, my dad and I traveled to the U.S. And did a two-man cowboy music show with a lot of humor in it. My dad's a professional humorist as well as a musician. So he was the funny guy, and I was the straight man that would set up the jokes, and I played guitar, and he played fiddle, and we sang harmony with each other, and we'd tell jokes and play these cowboy songs and just entertain people at you know, big association conventions, at corporate conventions, and that sort of thing. And almost, we played almost all 50 states. I think we may have missed 8 or 10 so far. But it was great. It was a great time traveling with my dad and doing that sort of thing. Yeah, we had a good career there. He's still with us, alive and kicking, still ranching. My parents are still ranchers, and my dad still learns a new fiddle tune every week. And so,
and you called yourself.
So I got good genes.
You called yourselves the Swing Riders. For those listening who don't know what a swing rider is, you want to just tell us a little bit about who a swing rider is? Yeah.
Well, in the old trail drive era, when the trail drivers would move a big herd of cattle up the Chisholm Trail or one of the other trails, the cowboys would position themselves along this long string of cattle going up the trail. For example, there were the drag riders were the young rookie cowboys, and they got the worst job dragging along behind the herd. They were called the drag riders. Along the flank of the herds, they had the flank riders on the left side and on the right side. But if you worked your way up through enough years, you were promoted to up at the front of the herd, and you would swing the herd in the right direction. That was your job. So those riders up towards the front were called the swing riders. Mm-hmm. And that's where we got the name for our cowboy duo.
So you guys promoted yourselves up to the front of the line.
I promoted my dad. And he promoted
I like it. Well, I'll tell you what. Let's get a couple of commercials out of the way, and then we will all be back with you. So hang on just a second. Don't go away. Bobby Jean, have you got your text in front of you?
I do.
Good girl.
Shall I go ahead?
Go for it.
Spring is here. Turn your mind away from winter storms and refresh your outlook. What events do you have coming up? An outdoor music festival? Trip to the mountains? A horseback ride adventure? Out West Shop has just what you need to revive your spirits and reboot your wardrobe. Cool, hip boho tops, stylish boots from Dan Post, and great-looking jackets are just a few of the fashion essentials offered for men and ladies. Find it all at www.outwestshop.com. Enter coupon code SPRING and save $10 on your order. Call toll-free if you want to talk to one of us at 1-877-340-9378. Out West delivers the West door-to-door, coast-to-coast, and around the world. And it's always a great day out West.
You know, if you're planning a trip and there's no way you can take your little canine buddy, how about considering All Dogs Rule Day Camp and Sleepover? That is right. All Dogs Rule good thing Russ isn't here. All Dogs Rule Day Camp and Sleepover is the premium place for your four-legged friends to spend their time away from you. If you want a place where you know your buddy will be safe and have lots of attention, being able to play with other dogs, goats, sheep, horses, and even more humans, then All Dogs Rule is the place for you. Acres of play space, grass, orange trees, the gorgeous Sespe River, and all with no stress. And extras if you want, just ask. When your dogs return home, you'll have to ask whose vacation was better. And we always know it's the dogs, so there you go. So check them out at their website at alldogsrule.com or give them a call at 805-524-1100. Your dog will thank you, and Russ will thank you, and Karen will thank you, and All Dogs Rule will thank you. And that's it for All Dogs Rule. Now, when Creative Edge Publicity was founded in 2016, they immediately showed that they weren't the same as other publicity firms. They work closely with their individual clients' needs and goals and push harder to get them noticed. Creative Edge believes that communication is an important part of the partnership, and that model is how they have built their success. They collaborate and work with local, national, and international media outlets and organizations to meet clients' goals. So Creative Edge, your brand, your future. Mickey Mickelson is the publicist. If you're interested, go to creativeedgepublicity.com and give Mickey a shout, and he'd be more than happy to give you a holler and work something out with you. So that's creativeedgepublicity.com. Okay, we are back in the studio. We have Mike Blakely with us and Bobby Jean Bell. And if you want to call and talk to Mike, the number here in the studio is 818-602-4929. Again, that number is 818-602-4929.
1, 2, 3, 4.
He can't betray himself or the horses that he rides. He goes to bed each night knowing that he tried. He had that filly rode until she pawed the bridle off. He still goes to town to show everything that he ain't lost. The wrong man saddles up and says, cock your hammer, son. Throws a leg over leather that he's still paying on. Well, the only way to hurt him is to let him fall in love. The last one was a rough one, but he ain't had enough. Yeah, the last one was a rough one, but he's still hanging tough.
And that's Michael Blakely, the Bronc Man, and that's off his new CD, The Outside Circle. I'm gonna assume, Mike, that you've taken a dump or two off a horse.
Well, yeah, I have. You know, I grew up in a ranching family and was horseback at a pretty young age. And that particular song, in fact, was written by myself and my friend Damon Rogers because we both got bucked off of the same horse. I got bucked off because she was a little bit too much horse for me. Damon's a professional horse trainer, and I've always done it as a hobby and to help out friends on their ranches and that sort of thing. But Damon's a pro, and the throat latch broke on the head stall. In other words, the mare, as he was trying to ride her, she was bucking like crazy. The bridle, she twisted the bridle off her head, so he had absolutely no control.
Oh, wow.
That's the reason he got bucked off.
Wow.
So anyway, so we sat down and settled down, and we started writing that song right there, The Bronc Man.
Huh.
I noticed, Mike, on this CD, this is just a fabulous CD. There were about three songs, I think, that two of you wrote together. You want to share a little bit about your collaborative process when you sit with another songwriter?
Yeah, sure. It can happen. Like in that particular instance, when we were planning to train a horse. We weren't planning to write a song. And Damon is, like I said, his daddy was a bronc buster, but his mother was an English professor at a college. So he had those skills too. He has the word skills and the horse skills too. So that one just sort of came out of nowhere. But yeah, I do collaborate with some other writers at times, and where you schedule a meeting and you sit down. The goal is to arrive at an intelligence that is greater than the two guys or the three people writing the song. You know, all of a sudden it feels like there's a smarter person in the room coming up with all these brilliant ideas. So that's kind of the goal. That's the reason you do it. Instead of getting bogged down in only your own thoughts and experiences, you can start bouncing stuff off other people. So,
sure.
Yeah, it's valuable sometimes. It works well.
Sure. Now, you've written books with other people as well, and I did one, and it was interesting. I don't know how you feel about it, but we found the hardest part was meshing the two pieces together. And I don't know, because we wrote a book, it was just one story, and each of us wrote a character, and making everything, the story mesh together between chapters that each one of us would write. You wrote one with Willie Nelson and a couple others, and how did that process go for you?
For me, it was, first of all, we had a series of meetings. You know, the Willie Nelson thing came first, and that led to the book with Kenny Rogers, and both those guys are great guys, and just really, they seemed to me like they didn't have any big star attitude or whatever, and we're very creative guys too, because you know it starts with coming up with a story and the characters,
right?
And there was no lack of ideas from either one of those guys, and they would put twists on the story that I would never thought of by myself. So yeah, it was interesting working with guys who were that creative and have made, you know, millions of dollars from their creativity through songs mainly, but it translates into prose as well.
Yeah, I haven't read them, but you know, I assume they're probably terrific, and of course, and you probably get more awards off them. And I'm sitting here going,
Well, you know, you can read them faster than I can write them. So,
well, that's actually true. That's true.
I know you're busy writing your own stuff, but
well, that's true. And then you know, I have a show to prepare for every week, and you know, don't have a whole lot of time like you. I mean, I run out of time. But,
you know, a secret that a lot of people don't realize is that we fiction writers don't read a whole lot of other people's fiction, because when you're writing a novel, you don't want to absorb somebody else's style by reading theirs.
Exactly.
So you have to be careful with that, and you have to wait for when you're between books or something like that, and then pick up a novel that you've been wanting to read.
Exactly.
And it's kind of an understanding among novelists that we don't all have time to read each other's books.
Right. Mm-hmm. And nobody feels bad about it. You know, it's just that's the way it is.
Have any of your songs, Mike, inspired your books, or have any characters in your books inspired songs?
No, that's a good question, and yeah, it does happen. In other words, the two careers can overlap and dovetail a little bit. For example, in my second novel, there's a song I wrote years ago called Mira las Palomas. It's this kind of half English, half Spanish song. And the story from that song just wanted to weave its way into one chapter in that book. And so I let it happen. In another case, I had a character named Adelia, and she was the main female character of my book at the time. This book was called Shortgrass Song. And I ended up writing a song, which was her husband, the character who's her husband, singing this song to her, you know, to her, Amelia. So, yeah, it can happen that the two careers can cross over. And sometimes you get a good song or a good chapter out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. When you're sitting down to write a song, do you, everybody does it differently. I used to be a musician years and years and years ago. I gave it up for Lent.
Mm-hmm.
But
no, I saw your track record. Yeah,
there, yeah, you for sure.
Big, you had a big thing going up in the Northwest.
Yeah, we did. We were pretty good. Because I did a lot of the music for the band, and there were times when I would sit down and I would write a title to a song. I would write a title, and then I'd write the words for it, and then figure out the music. And there are other times where I would be playing with a melody, and the words would just come. How does that work for you?
Usually, it comes with the idea, but almost immediately, a melody attaches itself to the wordy part. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
That I come up, like you said, come up with a song title or a hook, as they sometimes call it in Nashville or L.A. or whatever, and you get the hook of the song, and then all of a sudden there's just a melody out of nowhere that pops into your head, and you're off to the races.
Sure.
They just seem to come together to me.
Sure.
A lot of people will write an entire melody first and then put words to it, and that's, you know, whatever way works for you is fine.
Sure. I learned a long time ago, and I don't mean to share in your hour, but I will share anyway because I'm selfish.
Well, it's kind of your hour.
It's really called the Jim Christina hour.
Yeah, I learned a long time. I learned a long time ago that you know, music and bars and notes, they come and they go. But the meat of the music itself is the lyric or the poetry that goes with the music. And that's around forever. That never goes away. And that's what I've always liked about writing songs, is that those lyrics are always there. I mean, you know,
well,
it's...
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I agree with you. That's my philosophy, too. You know, I'm basically a lyric-driven guy as a musician and songwriter. I don't, you know, I don't have a degree in music theory. I'm not that into the music. I'm more of a folk musician who learned it from my dad, like he learned it from somewhere. So, it's about the story and the lyrics, and to me, too. That's the way I approach
What is your favorite type of music to write? I know, yeah, you've got some swing on this album. You've got some Western. Which do you prefer, or do you prefer both? Or do you like blues, or I don't know?
You know, it's been hard to choose, and I have trouble pigeonholing music or figuring out genres. It's all just music to me, and if it's good music, I just like it.
Sure.
I mean, I recorded a song with a reggae beat, you know, a couple of albums back, just because that's what the song wanted to be, in my opinion. And so I don't know what you call it. I mean, I do a lot of Western or cowboy music. You probably call it Americana, which is, you know, sort of folk American music. But I just don't really concern myself too much about how people are going to label it. And I live in Central Texas, near the town of Fredericksburg. And in this area, there are a lot of people who love songwriters. They love original music and who will accept any kind of music that you throw at them, even in the same show. I mean, you can play a blues song followed by a traditional hardcore country song followed by something jazzy followed by that reggae thing that I did.
Uh-huh, you know?
And people just don't raise their eyebrows at that. If it's good music, it's a good thing. So it's a good place for me to be living in. And feel like I have free rein to just play what I want to play, whatever comes out, you know,
sure,
comes out of the heart or soul or brain or whatever.
Sure. Here's another example of your new CD. This particular cut is called "Don't Ever Sell Your Saddle."
Along the country road, I saw a saddle one fine morning. Cowboy rig for sale, the sign said tied around the horn. So I stopped to look it over, and a man in boots and hat slid off of the tailgate neath the shade tree where he sat. He said, "I see you're in the market for a sure enough Western cack. Well, this one here has rode the hump off more than one bronc's back. I had it built in Idaho where I learned to buckaroo. Son, you've no idea the wrecks this saddle's pulled me through. Don't ever sell your saddle, son, that's what my old pa said. And I promised him I'd keep this one until the day I was dead. But through hard knocks in the coolies and troubles on the trail."
So I have to know, did you ever sell a saddle?
I have bought and sold a few yeah, but you don't want to sell your last saddle. I mean,
well, that isn't unless you've sold your last horse, and then you have no need for a saddle any longer.
Well, we wanted to, you know, it's a bit of a cliche to say don't ever sell your saddle. It's been used before, but when Damon came up with the idea, he saw a saddle for sale on the side of the road. He drove past it in his pickup truck, and he just called me. He said, you know, what's the story of that saddle? What, you know? So we decided to come up with a story, and we just wanted to have a little more, some more twist to it.
It's so wonderful.
It's a great little tune. It's kind of a snappy little, it's a toe tapper. So you done tap my toes, yeah. Mike. Bobby Jean.
Yes.
Did you want to ask Mike the question?
Oh, my gosh. It's that time, isn't it? So, Mike, do you ever get writer's block? Yes or no? And if you do, what do you do about it?
Well, we're on the writer's block, so we might as well talk about it.
Well, that's the premise.
it's not a big problem with me, but every writer has probably faced it. It's like, you know, if you're a good slugger in baseball, you can get into a slump or just not working, you know.
Sure.
So I do get writer's block, and what I usually realize after a while is the reason I got writer's block is because I don't know what I'm talking about anymore. So I usually stop, take a break from the writing, do a little more research, a little more reading, get back into the era I'm writing about or the subject I'm writing about, and find an idea that springboards the enthusiasm again. So that's the way I get beyond it.
Okay. You know what? Yeah, that's, I mean, yeah, mine is, I call mine writer's pause.
Yeah.
There you go.
You know, another question that we've had some listeners curious about is, do you read your own reviews?
Ah, yes.
And
good
how
question,
do you
Bobby
respond
Jean.
To them if you do read them?
You know, my publisher will send me reviews sometimes, or they'll use them to put on the book cover or whatever. So I have read them, you know, because if somebody sends it to me in an email, I'm going to read it. You know, how long will it take? But I don't really go looking for them. You know, I'm on to the next project by that time.
And, sure.
And it's kind of moot what the reviewers might like. I've been blessed with good reviews. You know, everybody gets a nasty one every now and then, or and maybe well deserved too. You know, nobody's perfect. But you know, to me, it's not about the money. It's not about the reviews. It's about the story. It's about giving readers an escapism experience where they can feel like they just took a trip somewhere after reading 10 pages or 10 chapters or whatever, and gives everybody a break from their, what may be a humdrum life, or it may be a challenging life or something like that. But if you can take a break from that and just take a little escape, that's what I'm supposed to be providing mm-hmm. to my readers and to the listeners of my music too. So that's what I focus on, not so much the reviews. But I like a good review.
Well, we all do. I mean, you know.
Who wouldn't? That feels good, of course.
Well, I mean, but we've had people on that absolutely live for the reviews. And if they get a bad one, it's like their whole day is ruined. And it's, no.
Stops them cold.
I have friends that I've spoken with this about, and some people do take it really hard.
They really do. You know, it's like, well, I spent all this time and all this sweat and tears and heartache and wrote this thing, and this guy didn't like it. Well, not everybody's going to like your work.
You know, one thing that helps me is I have the music career, too, and I can write a song in the morning and go play it at a gig that night if I'm ready to play it.
Sure.
And I can go play a two-hour show, and I play about three or four times a week anyway. So I'm out there getting some positive feedback from music
uh-huh.
fans.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of writers, most novelists and, you know, authors and book writers, don't have that luxury. There are some that play great music, but
right.
most of them don't have that luxury right. of going out and getting some feedback from some fans. With a book, especially, and Jim, you know what I'm talking about, you spend all this time writing it, and then it takes the publisher a year, year and a half, 2 years to get it out after
yeah.
you write it. So it could be years before you get any feedback at all, and so you kind of hang your hat on that, and you really want it to be positive.
Yeah, by then you've already taken off in another direction. So
yeah. Mm-hmm. That's true.
So, Mike, let me ask you, because I'm always curious about dual professions. Do you consider yourself a musician, singer, songwriter that writes books, or do you consider yourself a novelist that writes music and is a singer, songwriter?
Can kind of depends on the day of the week. if I have a gig that day, my head's kind of wrapped around making it to the gig on time. What songs am I going to play? Who's the audience? What am I trying to accomplish? And so that day, I'm a songwriter who writes novels.
Okay.
Every other day, I'm a novelist who plays music.
Okay. Is there a new CD in the works, Mike?
There, we have the songs together. I mean, there's always one in the works. But I've got enough songs to do another project. It's hasn't even been quite a year yet since The Outside Circle came out. It came out last June, so we're not in a big rush. But maybe this fall, we might start recording some stuff this fall. We'll just have to wait and see what everybody's schedule's like. I've got to talk to my record producer, Walt Wilkins.
I think all of us that host music radio shows in the International Western Music Association would be very eager for the next one.
Well, that's what
speaking,
I like
speaking
to
for
hear,
myself
Bobby
as well.
Well,
I think that you
exactly
took
what
us.
I like to hear.
Speaking,
I know you've been doing this for a while, but oh my goodness, you took us by storm last year. Even though it's embarrassing that we weren't familiar with your work, you made a tremendous impact in the genre, and we thank you for the gift you brought us with this music.
Oh well, take that and run, Mike. She doesn't say that a lot. Well, speaking from a radio host that does not host a music show, I have another song I'm going to play a real short cut from, and this is called The Hat Song by Mike Blakely.
Yes. Wonderful.
I bought a brand new Stetson hat, a pretty good one, 100 X's. I found it on the sale rack, a little hat shop down in Texas. I got a good deal on it, 'cause it had one little flaw, just a rough spot on the crown there, but that was all. See, I figured in the long run, that one little spot wouldn't matter. 'Cause when it's all said and done, and all torn and tattered, well, that one imperfection will not stand alone. I'm gonna make this hat my own. 'Cause it's the way you grab the brim a thousand times before you hang it, busting through mesquite limbs in the sky.
Now, Mike, I've had a lot of hats, and I've never seen one with 100 X's, ever.
Well,
I think the most I've ever seen is 10.
That's a very expensive Stetson hat. They do make.
Do they really?
That's the reason they do. Up to even 200 X's. But yeah,
wow.
100 X hat is bad for more than $100, I guarantee you that.
Yeah, it would be a pure beaver at that point, isn't it? They're not made of beaver felt anymore, are they?
They still do make them out of beaver
felt. Oh, do they?
Yeah,
okay.
There
are a lot of rabbit fur hats being made.
Right.
Too, but that 100X hat will be pure beaver fur. It will be, yeah.
And the original hat made in the 1840s, 50s, 60s, and 70s was made out of what? Wool felt.
It was wool felt?
Wool felt, yeah. It was cheap, fast, and they could make tons of them in a hurry.
Yeah, so when you say the original hat, you mean like the original cowboy hat?
Yeah.
That era, yeah.
The big wide brim plain hat.
It was that. Well, they trapped most of the beavers for
right.
one thing,
right.
and so the beaver, was hard to come by. But also there was the other thing that killed the beaver hat was that one of the royals back in England, I forget which one, started wearing these silk top hats.
Right.
Top hats.
So then the rage all over the world was to wear silk top hats then.
Right.
And that kind of put the beaver felt business up.
Too. Right.
Kind of saved the
yeah,
beaver.
Yeah, the wolf felt thing is true. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it allowed the beaver to come back eventually.
Anyway, we've got, you know what, we're out of time. This time has just flown by. I wish we had more time to chat with you, but we don't. We're out. Why don't you let our audience know where they can contact you, your website, which I've been on, actually, and your email address and Facebook and whatever you got going.
You bet. I mean, just go to MikeBlakely.com. You can Bing me or Google me. You know, use those search engines and type in Mike Blakely, and it should pop up there. That's my website. I have a Facebook presence. Look for Mike Blakely's official fan page on Facebook. And my email and my contact info is available on my website. So just track me down. I like to hear from fans, and always look forward to getting some feedback out there.
Well, you've got a new one.
Give me a holler.
You got a new one. Thank you so much for joining us, Mike. I know it's getting kind of late out there, but we do appreciate you sticking around and chatting with us.
Well, it's not that late. I'm fixing to go to the honky tonk.
Okay, good for you. Go have a Lone Star for me, would you?
Hey, Jim, thank you so much for having me on. Bobby Jane, thanks for calling in too, and talking to both of you.
Absolutely, Mike. Have yourself
so
a fun
glad
one.
We had the time.
Okay.
Take care, my friend. Next week we have a returning writer, Patrick Brown. Last time he was on, we talked about his book, Murder Justice, the first in the Maggie Lynn mysteries. Since then, he's written The Pennington Host. And the third chapter of the Maggie Lynn mysteries is now tentatively entitled Ghost Lake, but that's up for grabs at this point. But Patrick will be joining us. He's from Woodland, Washington. He'll be joining us next Thursday. And then, of course, the week after, we have two shows that week. The first one is with Judy Fisher on the 9th of April. And then we have, of course, April 11th, and I have no idea who's on that night, but we'll find out. So it's been a hoot. Bobby Jean, looking forward to having you in the studio. Bobby Jean will be with us the 9th and the 11th, live in studio. So make sure you make plans to turn it on and listen to Bobby Jean live. as opposed to Bobby Jean dead.
Yeah, exactly. We'll be taking a few photos.
Yeah, probably, because I mean, we don't get a chance to do that much anymore. We don't take many pictures anymore. We don't have a lot of people in the studio anymore, so most of it's on phone. So anyway, thanks so much for joining us, Bobby. I know it was a hassle coming in late.
Oh, no, I was thrilled to be on tonight.
Oh, good. Well, we were thrilled to have you, and thanks again for being with us. And Mike, thanks again for joining us. And for Russ Avison, who couldn't be here with us tonight, Bobby Jean Bell and myself, Jim Christina, we are out of here.